Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, and your chief investigator of images. You may have been enjoying the excitement of the first two podcasts, which have featured the archivist of Blenheim Palace, Dr. Alexa Frost, and Ophelia Field, the author of The Favourite. In those, we gave you some remarkable inside reveals from World Heritage Site Blenheim, where Sarah Churchill lived. And it was very exciting. We've had lots of changes happening with the podcast to give you all the more access to art history. So we've opened up a Patreon. You can find out more by going to patreon.com/artdetective. What we want to do is give you the highest quality podcasts ad-free. Those ads can be a real turn-off, can't they? And by giving us a little bit of extra support, it means that we can work harder and offer you more great art history reveals. We can also improve the quality of our podcasts, and we can keep making it if you keep supporting us. You can unlock all sorts of different things by going through and supporting us. You can get access to pre-sales on live shows. You can get exclusive video footage. I'll be going to lots of exciting places over the next few months, and I'll be doing little short clips that I'll upload to my site that you can then access and enjoy for free. The next episode is a big one. It is coming to you from Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery, where I'll be interviewing Pieta Greaves and Jenny Butterworth behind the scenes to talk about the reconstruction of the Staffordshire Hordes helmet, possibly the most single exciting Anglo-Saxon find of the last 10 years. So please continue to support us. Thanks, everybody. Enjoy. Today, very excited to be in Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery because of something that really hasn't happened in the last 10 years of this magnitude. Something this exciting in terms of Anglo-Saxon treasures. Introduce yourselves, my lovely guests.
I'm Jenny Butterworth. I am a heritage consultant and I have been project managing the project we're going to talk about.
Mm. We have to keep it secret still. There's still a reveal to come.
I am Pieta Greaves, and I've been, and I'm a conservator, and I've been working on the project doing some sort of the organic elements on the Horde helmet.
And what is it that we are so excited about today? We're dealing with the Staffordshire Horde, that huge find of 2009, of the most Anglo-Saxon gold and silver ever discovered in one place. But what's the big reveal, Jenny?
There's been a very large research project, best part of 10 years, and what that has definitively shown is that it contains the remains of one magnificent helmet, and we have made a reconstruction from the original parts of what we think it looked like.
And we have the image here in front of us, so you'll be able to get it with the podcast, Art Detective listeners. It is spectacular. Now, I have been a chief Anglo-Saxon nerd for about 20 years, and up until this point, we had, what helmets did we have? The Bentigrange helmet, that famous one with the boar on the top and the cross on the nose piece. The Coppergate helmet with the lovely Christian prayer running over the top.
And of course, Sutton Hoo, big famous one. This is better, isn't it? Am I allowed to say it's better?
Well, I think you can say that, yes. I mean, we're biased, obviously. We think it's great. But yeah, I think it's obviously, you feel like it's quite a close cousin of Sutton Hoo, I think. But yes, it is. I think it's the only one that we think actually had some form of bristly crest rather than a solid crest. And we know that because the conservation that Pieter did, it revealed this sort of paste in the channel that shows that it was a sort of like cement for holding something in there. And obviously we don't know exactly what that was, but in our reconstruction we've gone for horsehair.
Because, I mean, that's the difference, isn't it? I suppose when you look at the Sutton Hoo helmet, which is so iconic, which, you know, it's one of the British Museum's most famous holdings, but it doesn't have this massive prow of red horsehair, which again I think seems quite Roman. Were you sort of citing known examples when you were thinking about reconstructing it?
It was a mix between sort of what we know is already sort of existed in the Roman world. It's obviously a Roman type helmet in terms of style and shape, and the difference, the main difference being that the channel is quite low, so it had to be something that wasn't so heavy that it would fall over. Or so choosing the horsehair was really decided by the functionality of the channel itself and what actually would fit in there, because there are obviously other options.
Feathers.
Yeah.
I like the idea of a great big wooden.
But just some things just wouldn't fit in there, especially with the paste that was found through the analysis of the research project. You know, you can't get that paste of beeswax and animal glue in there and so many other things. So the horsehair sort of naturally was a product that we, you know, would work in that channel. So it seemed for us the more likely option.
And I mean, if we retrace our steps a little bit and think about the significance of this, what was found and what's happened over the last 10 years. So found in 2009, you know, more than 4,000 pieces, weren't there, fragments. And we're talking kilograms of gold, silver, but all in fragments.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really important to say, you know, that the reconstruction of the helmet is the result of an extraordinary collaborative process. So many people have been involved, first in the research, that, you know, there have been conservators, there have been scientists, archaeologists, art historians, all kind of, it's not like one jigsaw. It's actually like lots and lots of jigsaws all mixed together. So it's like sorting it out and then reassembling all the different objects that are in it, one of which is the helmet. And then obviously a whole team then of craftspeople as well of different sorts to build the reconstruction. So, yeah, it's been an enormous piece of work, really. But I think I really think it gives you, seeing the reconstruction of the helmet, all those 4,000 fragments, you sort of look at them, don't you, and you go, wow, they're really beautiful. Mm. But it's a bit hard to understand what you're looking at. Whereas when you look at the reconstruction of the helmet, you go, oh.
But it also sheds the hoard, I think, in a really different light as well. Because one of the things, I remember seeing the whole hoard exhibited together, and it filled tabletops just from one end of a huge room to the other. And I mean, what a exercise in putting the tiny kind of microscopic fragments together to make up particularly kind of the figural bands, the decorative bands. But for me, it was always about a collection of sort of high status military pieces that were pretty much smash and grab off the battlefield. You know, go peel off some sword pommels, take off a cross from the top of a standard, that sort of. But this is something else, isn't it? How do you think it's going to change our understanding of the hoard?
I think what it does initially is actually start, it sort of starts people thinking about the people, actually, that as a collection of broken weapons, it's quite hard for people to understand, really. But actually, as an object, you can start thinking about, yes, someone would have worn it, and then you can kind of relate back to the objects, and someone would have worn the crosses and, you know, carried the swords. And I think it adds people into the story, which could be seen as kind of, yeah, quite hard and difficult to kind of pull together in your mind if you don't know the world of the Anglo-Saxons and swords and how you use them. And so it's just a different way of thinking about
I like that. You still haven't let me try it on, of course. But I think that that is absolutely true. It's that idea of how does it sit on someone's head? What sort of an impression would the person wearing this have made? And yeah. I mean, we are talking royal, really, aren't we? Let's be brave. Let's put our neck out here, because I've had to be brave in the past with Sutton Hoo and say, yes, I think it's the royal house of Redwood of East Anglia. This could only have belonged to someone of the highest status, couldn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Chris Fern, who's the sort of archaeological lead on the project, he refers to it as a proto-crown. It's in that interesting period, isn't it, where kingship is really developing. And I think you do, it has a real presence when you look at the reconstruction. You can really feel that it's a powerful thing. Nobody is going to mistake you for somebody else if you're wearing it, are they?
But also, they are remarkably rare. I mean, while we'll find thousands of spears, and there's a good handful of swords, helmets are incredibly rare. Yeah. And I think that there is a preconception with later armoury that helmets are purely for protective purposes in battle. And we do find those, don't we, the sort of boring skull caps with... Just what you need. This is not the same thing. This is decorative. Would you say it's got a ceremonial function?
I don't know, you're the expert.
Well, no. You see, I get excited about the ceremony.
Yeah, I think, for me, I think what it says is it's about being seen.
Yeah.
But I think you could say that about a lot of the things in the hoard, couldn't you? They are altogether quite unusual. You know, the cross... you know, that we think is a standard cross, that's designed to be seen. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the other bits that are from, they're from sort of high status objects that mark you out. Yeah. And this is the ultimate marking out.
When I first came to see it, the curators were describing the people wearing these things as psychopathic peacocks, which I just think sums it up. And this is sort of the absolute peak of that, isn't
it?
But in terms of its reconstruction, in terms of its structure, it is delicate in places, isn't it?
Well, yes and no, because actually in terms of functionality, it would function and give you protection. So it's obviously got a steel liner, and if then the leather. And actually people think of leather as quite a soft material, but in reality, when you strike leather with a blade, it's quite hard to cut through it. Mm. And then the decorative elements are the most fragile. But when you put those all together and rivet them on and they're all tied together, actually when you hold it and move it, it doesn't feel fragile. It does feel like it's a functional object. I'm not sure how much on a battlefield, but certainly in everyday sort of movement, you wouldn't have to treat it so carefully, I think. I think it does have like an everyday use.
A robustness.
Yeah. There's a robustness to it, yeah.
And it's difficult, isn't it? Because with Sutton Hoo, we know that though it wasn't necessarily used in battle, because there's no battle scars, there's no cuts or damages. Yeah. But this was deliberately broken up, wasn't it?
Yeah, there are a lot of cut marks on the material, but probably from the removal and the taking apart of it rather than battle injury. So yes, we just don't know. But I think one of the crucial things that reconstructing it has shown is when the hoard was first discovered, those cheap pieces, you know, people were saying, oh, they're too small, or they're not hinged like Sutton Hoo. It could never actually be a helmet you could wear. Mm. But, you know, when we tried it on Mark, our lovely reenactor, you know, it's quite heavy. It's not impossibly heavy, but actually the cheap pieces really do work, and he could turn his head, and it's quite well balanced. It definitely, you can wear it, and it's functional in that sense, even if, you know, whatever you decide to do when you're wearing it. But it definitely works. I think we've answered those initial doubts about it, you know.
Yeah, but also, I mean, we can come on to talk about craftsmanship in a minute, but I want to have a little look at some of the imagery on it, because this is an art detective. We need to do some close visual analysis, my friends. There's a lot on there that we see on things like the Coppergate helmet, like that nose piece with the sort of animal interlace coming down it, which is quite traditional. But these figural panels are really exciting for me, because they are very identifiable. They're coming... there's sort of a lineage of these sorts of helmet panels, isn't there? What do we know about them, Jane?
Well, again, you are much more of an expert than we are about
You're not supposed
things.
To say that. It's true! You're being too kind to me.
But yes, I mean, there are parallels to these types of panels on the Swedish, the Valsgaard Vendel helmets, and Sutton Hoo, obviously, this forms that link as well. There's also, one of the panels is the is a motif of a rider on a horse kind of riding somebody down, and that crops up in lots of places. So yes, it has strong parallels, you know, across Europe probably, I suppose.
Because when I spoke to George Speak about it, because I asked him, is this a helmet that was made here or was it an import? And he, from the design, he said, you know, there is enough characteristics to say that it's more likely that it was created here. Yeah. So there are slight changes in the design where he can see those sort of, you know, slightly more Anglo-Saxon England designs to it.
But gathering...
Yeah, but using
influences.
a wider.
And again, you can say that about the whole horde, really. Can't you? It's an extraordinary sort of amalgam of styles and borrowings and developments.
And again, with that relationship with Sutton Hoo, one of the things that always strikes me is that we tend to think of the North Sea as sort of a divide, but it was a conduit. They were constantly exchanging goods, ideas. They tied their genealogies together across from East Anglia to Sweden. So, you know, it's our modern ideas of nationalities are very different from these sorts of genealogical connections. Yeah. And I think it's amazing you see these links. But it does seem to be coming out of East Anglia, doesn't it? Now that... Oh, how do we deal with that, given that it's found in Mercia? What do we do with this thorny problem?
I mean, I think, you know, throughout the research project, you know, Chris Fern, who's the art expert, has nobody has ever really been saying that these are Mercian objects. You know, the hoard obviously does belong to Mercia quite strongly in a modern identity way, but it's unlikely that many, if any, of the objects are made here. So they've all come from somewhere else. And so then you do think, you know, there are a lot of mechanisms in this period in which people gather wealth together, whether it's battle loot or tribute or gift-giving, aren't there? And you've got to, I think, this helmet and the hoard sort of fits into that.
She's being frightfully democratic, isn't she? Because I'm just saying, come on, tell me it's Pender's treasure battle treasure. That's what I want to hear. But we can certainly go with dates, can't we? Because I think everybody is pretty much coming down on the helmet being between 600 and 650. But, you know, I'm veering towards the latter.
There are other objects in the hoard which are probably older than that.
Yeah.
And yes, the helmet probably is that date. But then, yes, I think the burial is a little bit later, maybe up to 675. So it is that, you know, that is when Pender is around.
And of course, you know, if we talk about, this is the same problem, of course, that everyone faces with Sutton Hoo. Do we say it's Redwald, King of the East Anglians? Do we say that this collection has been put together on the basis of some sort of battle campaign led by someone extremely powerful who is conquering lands in Northumbria and indeed East Anglia? And again, you know, without this helmet having a, you know, Pender was here scratched on it. We can't be conclusive, can we? But it tells us a story, a narrative about conflict and about hegemonies, doesn't it? About changing powers of different kingdoms. Is that how you've read it as well, then, Peter?
I think what it says, well, as a conservator, I'm not an Anglo-Saxon specialist, but I think what it is these are people who have access to, you know, the kings, the warrior elite, and that can only be other kings and warrior elite, more like, you know, these aren't things that have been gathered by everyday people. So there's definitely a link there to whatever we think that warrior elite class of people are doing, and what we think they're doing is, you know, they're going off and battling each other, aren't they, and extending their power and influence and getting kingdom building. So, you know, obviously we'll never know for sure, but, you know, it's certainly one of the stronger arguments that could be made for it.
But in terms of its deliberate destruction, that's the other thing I've been fascinated about. What do we know about that? Because it was dismantled.
It's heavily destroyed, you'd have to say, as are, you know, many of the objects in the hoard. And obviously, this is really Pieter's side of things, but, you know, the silver panels are quite vulnerable. So some of the fragmentation is to do with the fact they've been in the plough soil for so many hundreds of years. But, you know, quite a lot of it we can see was deliberately done before. And, you know, the steel and the leather and the structure was completely absent. It's only the decoration that survived. And that's, you know, that's one of the reasons for doing the reconstruction, is to say, you know, we have this sort of shell of decoration, but we don't know how it works structurally as an object, and how do we take all those bits that were very deliberately taken apart and see how they fit back together.
And did you see deliberate? You were saying that the silver seems to have fared worse in the soil.
Yeah, so some things look torn, like you would after many years in the soil, silver and brittles over time. So some things just naturally break up, especially if they're in plough soil. But some things you can see definite cut marks on. Mm. So cut marks through to the bottom tray element before the cheek pieces. Those are deliberately cut up in places.
Wow.
And you can see on some of the decorative foils themselves, there are deliberate straight lines. You know, they can only be cut marks. But are they cut marks? At what point they got those cut marks? Is it destruction, or is it during the making? So it's answering those questions as well. It's like, do you need to cut it to fit it into a shape of the helmet? Do you need to cut it to dismantle it? So you sort of need to think those through those problems as well.
And the cheek pieces have each got two sort of lobes or tabs to attach them, and they're, you know, they're completely snapped off in a way that seems unnecessary.
They're quite extreme.
It's quite an extreme piece of taking it apart.
But you see that across the hoard, don't you? I mean, one of the most powerful images I remember when they first were coming out of the ground was the way that the sword pommels, the nails were completely bent back because they've literally been ripped off. But to me, that it's something different if you're going across the battlefield at the end of a battle, sweeping over like the eagles and ravens, look at me and my old English references, and peeling off these treasures, these bits that you can take away and sell on or melt down. That feels different to deliberately destroying what essentially is almost like the crown jewels, breaking up someone's crown deliberately. Now, you know, I would be able to kind of go on all sorts of flights of fantasy about what would cause that. But this idea of the deliberate destruction, I think, is really fascinating.
Yeah, and I would, in terms of what you would remove from a battlefield, I don't know if you would remove the gold elements from a sword, given that the sword blade itself is also really useful.
Worth more.
So I'm not sure how much of this would actually be done on a battlefield. I think it's probably easier to take the objects as whole and dismantle them elsewhere.
And reuse those blades, shields.
So I think it's quite complicated about how, even when you take things apart and who gets who and what goes where, and I think it's quite a complicated process. And that's either, you know, in terms of destruction, you can either think of it ritually or functionally.
Yeah.
So in terms of if this was going to be a hoard that was to be melted down, say, then you do want to cut up things quite dramatically because it helps you melt them down easier. So there are arguments for both camps, really, about why this, or it's a bit of both, or it's done.
Yeah. And I think also that destruction and what Peter's saying also tells us about our other really interesting group of people that relates to the hoard, and that is the craftspeople.
Absolutely.
You think probably at both ends of the process there are craft people involved.
Good point.
And you know, you of all sorts, really. But I think that's there's a specialist hand in the hoard in many different ways.
And even if they are melting down the materials, they came back to the craftspeople to be potentially used. But of course something holds that up, in as much as the stuff is buried.
Yes.
Buried quite deliberately, buried in the roots of a tree. Is that was some idea at some point, wasn't it? It was buried under an oak tree or something.
I think that stems back to when they did an excavation. There's the sort of the hilltop where it was buried, the sort of geology, and thus probably the environment's a little bit different there to some of the surroundings. So, and it was a sort of, you know, your old sort of ancient oak pasture sort of scrub. So I think that's where those ideas come from, and you know, that's still true. The geology of the top of that hill is a bit different,
and it's on a crossroads, isn't it? It's on a junction between Lichfield and Tamworth.
It's
between the Royal Court and the Ecclesiastical Centre, isn't
it's near, yeah, it's quite near Lichfield, and it's on the what was Watling Street, the Roman Road, which is still a sort of arterial route, I guess, in this period. And it's a really distinctive hilltop. You know, when you stand next to it and you look at it, you think, oh, yeah.
That's where I'd leave a punch in.
Yeah.
You know, if I was going to come back for it, I'd know it was there. Or, you know, if I wanted somewhere that stands out as a it's an interesting spot for sure.
Well, then coming back to the craftspeople, because this is the other bit that's hugely fascinating about this reconstruction. They've had to go back to techniques, as much as we know about craftsmen's techniques of the Anglo-Saxon period. What bits were particularly exciting for you as a conservator to see them remaking?
I quite like the bits I did.
They're the best bits.
Yeah.
They are the best bits.
But I think the whole thing was thinking about looking at the evidence that we could found through the research project and then bringing it to life, really. I think that's the... And actually taking that thing where we think it's made from these things... Mm. Is it made from these things? Can we make this work? And I think that's been the biggest interest to me, and actually being able to go, especially in the crest with the beeswax, you know, can we make that work? Does it stand up? Yeah, does it stand up? Should it stand up?
Yeah.
You know, because that's the other thing as well. Should it be flopped over? Should it be a different colour? Should it be, you know, just sort of lots of options.
And I think the helmet and the hall generally, the scientific analysis is showing that actually it's full of... obviously, it looks like a set of gold and silver objects, but it is full of pastes and glues and funny little bone bits and wooden bits to make it work. And actually, so the helmet, you know, like the band around the bottom with the foil sort of set in beeswax and Pieter reproduced that. So you get this... it's a proper sort of mixed media thing that involves craft of lots of different sorts. It's not just... a goldsmithing.
Well, this is one of the challenges we're constantly up against on Art Detective, is that sort of our idea of an artwork is a painting hanging on a gallery wall, but actually the craftsmanship of an age gone involved lots of different mediums, loads of which we don't have. So we lose all our perishables. We lose our leather, our bone, our wood on the whole, unless it's found in these fragmentary pieces. But you were working then with people who were presumably toughening up the leather... and we were working alongside each other. How did the kind of reconstruction aspect come along?
Well, yes, that's quite interesting, because me and Jeannie was actually discussing this the other day about how we're kind of not sure if we're going for the right way in, because obviously we started with the outside and we built in, but when you made it originally, would you start from the inside and build out and then make things fit? Which bit would you actually start with as an Anglo-Saxon maker to make the helmet the right size for the person?
Yeah, because we effectively had to retro-engineer it to understand how it was built. But obviously they wouldn't have done it that way around. No. So that was interesting. And I think the other thing is that obviously... there were probably not a lot of craftspeople then who were capable of doing it either, but they probably would have worked in a more... You know, we are, like, when we were looking for an armourer to make the steel, everybody we went to recommended Geoffrey Hildebrandt, who's in Canada, because he is the best armourer. Now, probably, it probably isn't really ideal that he's not here with us, but there isn't an option, because there aren't that many people who are experienced at crafting that sort of thing. So our process had to be pragmatic. But I think we definitely learned that the assembly of it and so on is a... It can't have been one craftsperson doing it. One person doesn't have enough hands, literally. You know, it took Pieter and Sam Chilton, the metalsmith, a lot of weeks of intensive joint work to make it fit together. So that, I think that's interesting.
And also when you put, so the decorative panels are attached to the leather, so every time you put a rivet in, a little bit of the tension of the leather changed. So as you went round, it also sort of moved in slightly different ways that you didn't expect. And so it's sort of like tensioned in many different ways as you go around the helmet. Yeah. And then you attach it to the steel. Yeah. So it'll be, it's interesting to see.
And I like what you said about, because at one point I was saying, can you speed up? Can we just like drill the holes?
Oh, you fell asleep.
Leatherwork, because I know you really can't, because the leather sort of, it heals itself a bit when you put the rivets through, but obviously if you've drilled it, like you're saying, you've interrupted the tension and it's just not the same. So I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, so the leather closes really quick, so Sam would use an awl to put the hole through, but if she didn't get the rivet through fast enough, the hole was closed.
Oh,
so it's also quite a frustrating process.
So did you make up the leather as well then? Because that's a whole new...
Yeah, so Mark, the man we see who's wearing the reconstruction, he's also a leather worker. So he created the leather form underneath based on the steel.
Yeah.
And then reattached the decorative elements.
Because you made that really interesting decision the way it's exhibited as well. I love the fact you can see right up inside and see how it's all tied together, what's happening in there. Was that an actual decision, or is that just you didn't have anything else to put in there?
It wasn't a falling out, but we didn't. We didn't agree.
We're in different camps on
there. Like, if you look at the Sutton Hoo replica in the British Museum, it's an extremely tidy object, and the inside is lined with what looks like quite a beautiful sort of kid or goat or something. And the question was, should we do the same to this one? And
many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is Plush Care. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
When the director of collections here took the decision about this one, that not, because, and I think I like that. It means you can see that it's got a bit of steel inside it. And, you know, maybe when Mark tried on, he had a sort of rough wool cap, you know, of the sort that I'm sure everybody had in the early medieval period. And I think, you know, maybe that's how they did it. You know, you have a thing that you put on first. You might even have a sort of bit of padding here, and then you drop your helmet on. We don't know if it was lined or not.
I guess in a practical sense, if you also took it out in the weather, that lining would have to be sort of stuck on with something, either an animal glue or a wax. And actually, that probably wouldn't fare very well long term.
Yeah.
So actually, in a practical sense, they're probably not very useful linings.
Yeah.
You know, because they'll just fall off over time.
But then I think we're, again, this is why I kind of come down on the side of these things being used as crown jewels, ceremonials, things that come out once in a while. Your battle hardy leather skullcap's going to do most of the work. But something like this, I think it is for parading. I think, you could well wear it on the battlefield and be recognised by your men as the leader, the ruler, the king, the one wearing the gold helmet. But on the whole, I think it's probably... That's just how I see it. I like to see the king sat in the throne wearing a great big gold helmet.
Yes. I mean, I'm not sure you'd want to take your horsehair out in the rain.
No. A lot of this beeswax is going as well on a rainy day, isn't it? So let's have a little think then about how this is going to change our understanding of the hoard, but also this period in Mercia's history, this period in this area's history. Why is it so significant?
I think in modern terms, it's extremely significant because it is a new step in helping audiences understand the hoard when they look at it. You know, it's a great step forward in understanding the process that all those fragments originally derived from a much smaller number of discrete objects like helmets, swords, maybe saddles, you know, all sorts of things. So I think that's very important. But I think the other thing, which we probably haven't said enough, is that this helmet is the first step in publishing all of the research. You know, as we said earlier, it's been a huge team in the research. You know, it's funded by Historic England and the museums, lots of experts. And this is just part of the bigger story of what all of the hoard tells us about Mercia and its neighbours. And, you know, that will be published next year. And I think then you can really start unpicking what the hoard means and what it tells us about the Mercian story. And, you know, that story will never be finished, but there'll be an awful lot more data out there. Mm. And we should, I mean, the really great thing is, as well as the big publication, the entire catalogue will be released free the Archaeological Data Service. So anybody will be able to look at all of these objects themselves and see what they think.
Wow. And is that the same thing? I mean, maybe coming at it from a slightly different point of view as conservator, that we're learning a lot about the making as well, aren't we, which is new.
It is, and I think it's, definitely. I think there's a greater appreciation that these objects are, you know, created by real craftspeople. Mm. You know, you don't really see the detail until you get underneath the microscope, and you kind of just think, why have they done that? When only I can see it really close. It is, I think that extreme level that these people were just master craftsmen that has really come out of this process as well. Mm. That they had a great understanding. Actually, one of the scientists who did the paste analysis on the beeswax, he said it was interesting for him to think about people who, you know, if you're a beekeeper, you probably, there's not a lot you're going to do with the elite class. So there are these people who kind of are in this world where they kind of go from the bottom to the top of society, gathering these materials to make these sort of, these kingly objects.
Yeah, and in the middle of those, you've got these sort of almost like Welland the Smith godlike like craftspeople who do seem to be able to defy nature with their microscopic skills, that their eyes must have been getting older with the more experience they got. But the delicacy of some of that cloisonné work, the beading on this blew my mind when I went to see the on the reconstruction. Yeah. It's incredible to think how they did that with no electricity, no running water.
Yeah, I think you have to be naturally quite short-sighted, I think, to really do it.
Maybe you have an army of small children.
nimble fingers to your eyes. I think that's...
Yeah.
I think it's one thing that Kevin Leahy, one of the experts, also said also is that they must have had an extraordinarily good understanding of colour temperature and an understanding of fire and furnaces. You know, now we do it all with a thermometer, but they must have totally, because particularly some of the soldering, it's so precise. I mean, there are a few bits in the hoard where it's gone a bit wrong, but they're not that many. You know, mostly it's really good. You know, they must really have understood exactly what temperature their furnace was when they were doing stuff. And I think that's really interesting.
I mean, from this one object, from this helmet, we can think about the individual that wore it, we can think about how it was taken, how it was dismantled, and then we can blow this object up onto all these platforms where we're looking at furnaces and beekeepers and the workings of a battlefield. It's a gateway into all of that, isn't it, which I think is what makes it so exciting. Guys, we've got to tell people how they can come and see this helmet. How can they come?
There are actually two exactly the same, one at the Potteries Museum in Stoke-on-Trent, one at Birmingham Museums here, and they're both on display from today, so anyone can come and see them. Or you can, on the internet, use the hashtag HoardHelmet on Twitter to find out more information.
Fantastic. It is such a pleasure. I could talk about this helmet. I probably will continue to talk about this helmet for many, many years to come. But it's an honour to be with you both and to see it in the flesh like this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Remember to subscribe to the show, and if you can't support us on Patreon, don't worry, you can help us by sharing with your friends and followers the Art Detective link, and also leaving us a review on iTunes. Every little thing helps. Thanks, guys.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, where are you, the police?
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. acast.com.